welcome everyone. It's an unusually beautiful Ides of March here in East Lansing. Hard to compete with 70-degree weather, but it's a great pleasure to welcome you all. Thanks for coming. I'm introducing the illustrious David Goldblatt, the author of The Bible of Football History. The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer, all 900 and something pages. The Football Scholars Forum invited David to speak. He's going to be hosting a session tomorrow at 2 p.m. This is an online book club that we run out of the history department. And we tackled the first half of David's book in 2010, and we're closing it this time around. So David's also authored a couple of other books. He's a regular columnist and a book reviewer for various media outlets in the UK. He's also taught in the Department of Sociology at the University of Bristol, as well as at the Open University. And he's currently a visiting professor at Pomona College in California.
Pitzer.
Excuse me, Pitzer College. Apologies. Pitzer College. Close to
Pomona. Yeah.
Not too far. And he's teaching a course on football as well as two other courses there, so they're working him up hard. He's also an award-winning documentary maker, radio documentary maker for the BBC, both World Service and Radio 4, and he's covered an eclectic number of topics, including, of course, football, but also the economics of baseball in the Dominican Republic, football and social development in the slums of Nairobi, Kenya, and on the globalization of cricket, which I don't know how many people know, but the International Cricket Council is now based in Dubai. So, and run largely by South Asians. So it's a sort of interesting, extra Western-driven kind of globalization of sport in that case. And I want to thank the department and Walter for helping bring David here. And the title of the talk is something along the lines of soccer can be taken out of politics, but politics cannot be taken out of soccer. And we're going to hear about particular case studies that David has worked on recently that bring this theme out into the open. And we'll have some time for Q&A as well at the end. So welcome, David.
Thank you very much. I'm going to stand here, Alex. So is that okay camera-wise? Because I feel like I'm chairman of the board down there, and I really don't want to be. I'd rather get a little bit more intimate. Well, thank you very, very much for having me. I really appreciate you bringing me here. It's great to finally get off the coasts of the United States and see something else. And it's a great pleasure to be talking about football and politics. I've only got 45 minutes. My God, I could go on for hours and hours. I promise I won't. A little glance at the newspapers in the last year would have revealed simply innumerable stories about the relationship between football and politics. For example, going on right now in Turkey, there is a very high-level trial of the president of the club of Fenerbahce and a number of the significant members of that board. Fenerbahce, for those of you who don't know, is the team that ties its identity and its history most closely to the secular Turkish revolution of Kemal Atatürk, and claims, as in fact all clubs in Turkey do, that Atatürk was a supporter of the club. But I think in the case of Fenerbahce, you can say he probably was. And this is without question a trial over match fixing, but it is tied intimately to the struggle that is going on inside Turkish politics between the new moderate Islamist governments of the last 5 or 6 years and the deep-rooted institutions of the Atatürk secular state, what's sometimes referred to as the deep state. And as we know, the Prime Minister of Turkey has been waging a judicial war against these folks, and the Fenerbahce guys are absolutely at the centre of that network. And of course, football being such a kind of prominent and central feature of everyday life in Turkish society, if you want to make your point, it's an incredibly powerful one to take the guys at the head of Fenerbahce to court. And let me say, match fixing has been going on for quite some time in Turkish football. It's not like this just popped out of the ether. So there we have it in Turkey. If you go to Brazil over the last year and over the next few years, you will find the most intense political high-level struggle, as well as a struggle going on at the grassroots level over the urban regeneration and development of many Brazilian cities in association with both the World Cup and with the Rio 2016 Olympics. And just to give you a little taste, because I've been laughing at this video myself, but it's so good, just to give a sense as historians, what can be learnt about the texture and feel of everyday life and attitudes in a society, I want to show you the conclusion of the Paulista Cup, one of the kind of significant football tournaments that we have. It's this one up here. And I want you to imagine, I don't know if it quite happens like this, but I want you to imagine the Detroit Tigers have won the World Series, okay? And Bud Selig is handing out the rings, all right? Just imagine, that's the kind of context. Just watch what the gentleman in this video does with one of those precious rings, or in this case, a medal. And the gentleman to look for, okay, who's handing out the medals, is the man in charge of the Brazilian Football Federation, and in fact the man in charge of the Brazilian World Cup. So this is a very significant player. So just check out what happens here. Hold on, let's just take that back to the beginning. Look, watch. And there it goes. Now, if that were to happen in the United States, I'm not sure Bud Selig would survive as commissioner of MLB. But in Brazil, this man's position is not challenged. You can go on national television and you can get away with doing that. And it's worth noting the Corinthians, in the longer clip, the Corinthians goalkeeper comes up, last person in the line. There's no medal for him. There's no medal for him. Does anybody care? And this is indicative. I mean, this speaks, you know, in a sense, Brazilian football merely reflects a wider culture of corruption, of just the most barefaced cheek amongst the elites of Brazil with regard to the public. And this seems to me symptomatic of it. And if you look a little more closely into the way in which the Brazilian World Cup is being organised and the kind of slum clearances that are going on, the land grabs of favela land that will be used for regeneration and redevelopment, this is a pretty good way into the kind of everyday feel and texture of Brazilian politics. Bahrain, I don't know if you noticed that you're probably not following Bahrain versus Indonesia. It's not a terribly important football match, but it was to the Bahrainis. Bahrain had the opportunity to qualify for the World Cup in 2014. They needed Qatar to lose, okay? But if Qatar lost and they won by 10 clear goals, they're in the World Cup. What do you know? No, sorry, 9 clear goals. They lose 10-1 to Indonesia. They win 10-1 against Indonesia. Now, 10-1 is not a very regular scoreline in soccer, as I'm sure you will know. And particularly, one should note the Indonesian goalkeeper who rushes out about 3 minutes into the game and virtually rugby tackles one of the Bahrainians, ensuring, of course, that they will be sent off. And they duly lose it 10-1. And this speaks, you know, not merely to sort of widespread corruption, which is in sports of all kinds, but the desperation to which ruling elites in many parts of this world will go to get themselves to the World Cup, or indeed to host the World Cup. It's worth noting one of the sort of great political, international political shenanigans of last year was the bun fight to host the 2014, 2018 and 2022 World Cups. In which, for example, the British, or the English, in fact, the English FA were so desperate to get the World Cup, they were prepared to put the Prime Minister, Prince William, so the second in line to the throne, and of course David Beckham, who counts effectively as royalty in England at the moment, to put these people out on the line for 3 days to beg, literally, the members of FIFA to bring the World Cup to England. The most notable thing, of course, about the contest is that Vladimir Putin didn't show up. And why didn't Vladimir show up? Because he knew it was in the bag long before the discussions and the debate began. But it is indicative, it seems to me, as well as being a kind of amusing story, of the kind of incredible significance as a form of soft power that football has acquired in the last 20, 30 years as it has become more globalised, more televised, and more integrated into both the sort of popular and, in some cases, elite cultures of many parts of the world. I could go on, and I will, and I will be delighted to speak about all of these topics at the end in a Q&A, but I thought I should give you something a little more focused for the next sort of, 35, 40 minutes rather than spread oneself too thinly. And I'm living in Southern California at the moment. I come from a city called Bristol in the west of England, and it's been truly extraordinary to look back to England and find how little and irrelevant and distant and far away it is from California. And I think as a kind of historian and sociologist, that has been fantastically interesting to suddenly see home in a completely different way. And so I've been doing a lot of writing and a lot of thinking about the cultural politics of football in Great Britain as a whole, and within that England, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales. And I've also been thinking about Europe. And Europe, I can tell you, in California, simply does not figure. In the time that I've been, I've read the LA Times pretty much every day. And with the exception of Kate Middleton occasionally making it as to whether she's pregnant or not, the structural adjustment program that's going on in Greece, that is pretty much all there is. I have not read a single article in the LA Times. Oh, on the inside page, the Scottish referendum. Right, on independence. That's once in 3 months. So it's an interesting moment again to take a look at Europe when it looks so different and so far away. And two of the two big football tournaments of the year, international football tournaments of the year, you may come across later on in the year, are the London 2012 Olympics and its football tournament, and the European Championships, which are being held in Poland and Ukraine. So I'm going to talk a little bit about both of those events and think a little bit about the cultural politics of the football that will be going on, and hopefully that will make watching them a little more interesting when it comes round to it. So to start with the Euros. The European Championships, which take place over 3 weeks in June and July, are probably, in terms of global audience and global TV rights, about the third biggest event in global sport. I mean, obviously the World Cup and the Olympics are way ahead. There are a number of events, be they Super Bowl or the Indian Premier League cricket, which have gigantic domestic audiences and huge amounts of money involved. But these in the end are pretty much national phenomena. I mean, they have an international audience, but essentially they're about India, they're about the United States. So in terms of, more global or regional transnational phenomena, the Euros are about third. And they began in 1960, and one of the interesting things about that is that's pretty late. I mean, Europe is the home of football, and yet by 1960, Africa has a tournament for its national team starting in 1957. In Latin America, they've been going since 1916. Even in North America and the Caribbean, you have international tournaments prior to Europe. What an extraordinary thing. More than that, the actual institutional infrastructure that organises football in Europe, UEFA, is only born in 1954, which again makes it later to the game than the Latin Americans, later to the game than North America and Central America. Why should it take so long? How extraordinary that this should be the case. Well, of course, the reason is that, Europe is in flames for the previous 30 years, and the idea that there could be a pan-European institution while you're going through two hegemonic world wars is quixotic at best. Though it is a measure of the degree of emerging European identity and European integration in the aftermath of the Second World War, that UEFA is formed with such rapidity and enthusiasm after the war and concludes and the German situation is settled. In 1960, they play the first tournament. It's a very, very small thing. It's four teams, semi-finals, a final, no big deal. The qualifiers are all played very quietly. And it already acquires a kind of political dimension at this point, because Spain are due to play the Soviet Union in the semi-finals. And Franco decides that this is not permissible. And in fact, Spain, who would probably have won the tournament, are taken out of it. So it's an early boycott. But this is a very small event. No one's really taking a lot of notice. By 1964, things are getting a little more serious, and television is beginning to arrive and broadcast these things. And in the 4 years between 60 and 64, there's been a complete turnaround in politics in Spain, and Franco, with his Opus Dei technocrats, has begun to open up the economy and, unwittingly, Spanish society to the outside world, the opening of the tourist industry and so on. And Spain actually ends up hosting the 1964 European Championships. And delightfully, as history often throws up, what do you know, the Soviet Union are going to be in the final against Spain in a kind of effective replay of the game that never happened. And that's interesting. Spain win, and the Spanish make an enormous deal of it. The Spanish press at the time, if you have the opportunity to read it, is full of the most extraordinary claims that this Spanish team, full of fury, full of anger, a kind of characteristic fascist Spanish machismo, you know, has beaten the Reds and showed them what's what when it comes to political systems and how to play football. So it's already acquired a little bit of an edge. 1968 Italy is mainly remembered for the toss of a coin. It's one of the few occasions in a global sporting event where a match has actually had to be decided by the toss of a coin. The semi-final between Yugoslavia and Italy was a draw at extra time. There's no penalties, as we now have, to settle one of those games, and so they toss a coin. And I can tell you, in Yugoslavia, no one believes that it had a head and a tail. That was definitely a two-headed coin, as far as they're concerned. In 1976, it's the first moment at which we go behind the Iron Curtain. And that's kind of interesting in the sense, A, it took so long, and B, that football becomes one of the very rare areas in European life where you actually do get some kind of cultural interchange across the Iron Curtain. I mean, the only other example is probably the Eurovision Song Contest, which is a whole another story of cultural politics. And it's in Czechoslovakia, and what's interesting is A, the Czechs win, B, they beat the Germans, you can imagine how that goes down, and C, most interestingly, it's a team composed almost exclusively of Slovaks, which at the time, in the Czech part of Czechoslovakia, goes very unmentioned, but is a massive historical memory amongst Slovaks, you know, and part of, you know, a small part of the process of the emerging sense of Slovak nationalism, which ultimately results in Slovak independence in 1993-1994. Things really start getting interesting at the Euros, though, in a kind of wider political sense in the 1990s. And that's for a number of reasons. First of all, the scale of the show has become immeasurably larger. European football has become commercialised. We have the globalisation of television, the first hints of a truly global audience for an essentially European event. And you have the phenomena of travelling fans. Now, we have travelling fans prior to this. 1988 in particular, there's probably 80 or 90,000 foreign fans make it to Germany. But in 1992 in Denmark, it is a gigantic. It's the first time that it's truly a public kind of carnival and cavalcade, I would say, of European identities being expressed through the medium of football support. And the Danes, it's hosted in Sweden, and the Danes are not even going. They're beaten in their group by the Yugoslavs. But in between qualifying for the European Championships and attending the European Championships, Yugoslavia ceases to exist. So they can't go. They can't agree. The Serbs are saying, you know, you can't have Serbs, you can't have Croats, there's no Yugoslavia, what are you going to do? You call the Danes. The Danes are all on the beach at this point. They're called up, and the context of this is the Maastricht Treaty, which is being negotiated and signed at this time. And Denmark, it's a massive debate. Do we sign up to full European integration? Are we prepared to contemplate joining the European exchange rate mechanism, which is the forerunner of the euro? How far is Denmark going to go into Europe? And Denmark is feeling generally bullied, you know, and particularly bullied by the Germans and the French, who are going, come on, come on, come on. And they're going, I don't know, maybe not. As many Scandinavians have their concerns about European integration. And the story of the tournament is Denmark are amazing. Out of nowhere, off the beach, they show up, they make it all the way to the final. And as, you know, the gods of football sometimes do us a kind of sociological favour, it's Germany against Denmark. What chance have little Denmark got against Germany? Germany are absolutely the favourites. These are the champions. They've just won the 1990 World Cup. And in front of a gigantic European audience, the Danes beat the Germans. And in Denmark, in Copenhagen, outside the City Hall, you have the largest gathering of humanity in the country's history, with the exception of the celebrations over the liberation in 1944. So that's the kind of scale that these things can take, is that you have, hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of people gather. And in the Danish sort of collective folk memory, this is a pivotal moment in Denmark saying, yes, we're Europeans, but we don't want to go the whole way, which is very much how Danish foreign policy has worked out, and it solidifies that attitude. So in that sense, I suppose I'm trying to encourage you to think of football not merely just as a reflection, which it often is, of already existing cultural ideas or trends or economic institutions, but on rare occasions, these symbolic displays, these imagined communities, actually shape and direct the pace and form of historical change, rather than merely being just reflections of it. In 1996, the European Championships comes to England. A pivotal moment for England, because England has not been competing in international football at club level for most of the previous 6 or 7 years, after the Heysel and then the Hillsborough disasters, which you may know about, and both stadium disasters in which numbers of people are killed, and the general concern around the behaviour of English football supporters when overseas. English clubs are banned from European competition. They're just coming back in the early 1990s. And football during the era of Thatcher has reached its ground zero of social acceptability, of economic viability. You reach a point where the Sunday Times, which is the main cheerleader for the Conservative Party, describes football as a slum game played by slum people in slum stadiums. So it's gone as low as it can go. And there is a strange return and ascent over the next decade from the kind of Heysel in 1985, where football regains a certain degree of social acceptability, where the behaviour of its fans most certainly changes. And of course, there is a massive economic and institutional revolution in which the Premier League is created, in which you have a much more kind of privatised and profit-driven model of football, and you have all-seater stadiums, which transform the environment, the feel and the look of the game. And so the ascent of English football, which continues, really begins in this era. And for the European Championships to come back to England at that point, or for the first time to be played in England, is a moment of, we're back and we're acceptable again. And the cultural sort of meaning of football is slightly in flux. What is so extraordinary about that tournament is not the football, though the football was pretty good. And the penalty shootout with the Germans was great. But what's really interesting is what you see in the crowd. Now, if we just track back a bit to 1966, when England won the World Cup, I was watching the footage of it the other day. Have a look at the crowd. And what you will find is that the Union Jacks, the flag of Britain, right? And you will find the flag of St. George, the flag of England, which is white with a red cross. The ratio is 25-1 in favour of the Union Jack. And indeed, the entire iconography of what is a pivotal moment in the collective English national memory, and I do mean English because the Scots, the Irish and the Welsh do not think they won the World Cup and are actually incredibly annoyed that every time it's spoken of, it is a British phenomenon, where it is clearly an English phenomenon. But the iconography of the tournament is all British. So if you look at the mascot, I regret the introduction of mascots. I think they are the most ludicrous element of the World Cup. But we have the world. We have a mascot for the first time. World Cup Willy, and World Cup Willy, said without a trace of irony at the time, was a lion, and that's an interesting thing. Lions. Okay, first of all, he's a lion. Okay, and he's got a waistcoat on. And it's a Union Jack waistcoat. It's England's World Cup, but it's a Union Jack waistcoat. If you look at the programmes of the time, it's the Union Jack all over it. It's not about England, it's about Britain. There is a kind of profound confusion between the two. And he's a lion. Now, you're probably familiar, England's badge is three lions, right? As my friend Gregory said on returning from watching England lose disastrously to Germany in Bloemfontein at the 2010 World Cup, he had this sort of moment, this epiphany. He went, why are there lions? There are no lions in England. There have never been any lions. Big cats, maybe, but lions? And we have the lions because the lions are part of the heraldic crest of the Plantagenets. The Plantagenets, who were the French-speaking, right, French-focused ruling elite for about 300 years between the 12th and the 15th century. And so we have French-speaking aristocratic heraldic motif has been transmuted bizarrely into the England icon, you know, which then gets wrapped up not in Englishness, but a Union Jack. This betokens, it seems to me, a late imperial state and a public that is somewhat confused about its identity. If you then fast forward to 1990, England make the semi-finals of the World Cup in Italy. And again, it's a sort of central element of the English national sort of footballer's redemption and return story after, again, this long period of kind of disastrous performances. Again, we look at the flags. It's now shifted, I would say. It's about 75-25 now between Union Jacks and St George's flags. Euro 96, there is not a Union Jack to be seen. It is a truly extraordinary shift. Nobody planned it. Nobody organised it. There's nothing from on high. You don't even have the commercial retailers selling the flags, which we do 15, 20 years on. The kind of big retailers, the Home Depots, the Walmarts of Britain, of England, are flogging Union Jacks like crazy. No one's doing this in 1996. And yet, for some reason, you have Wembley Stadium with 100,000 people in it, completely, but completely full of St George's flags. This is, I have to tell you, as an Englishman, is the first time in my entire life I have seen the flag of England collectively displayed in such a public way. Completely extraordinary. Even the faceplate. It's red and white, but there ain't no blue, because there's no blue in the St George's flag. We'll come back to the details of that in a minute. Let me just finish off on the Euros while I'm there. So that's the really interesting thing about Euro 96, is that, you know, what we already knew, that football at these tournaments could become, I suppose, a spontaneous public theatre for experimenting with and displaying popular forms of national identity. Finally, it comes to the English. The next sort of key political moment, I mean, there are many in the one in the days to come. But let's just fast forward to 2012, which is what's coming up in Poland, Ukraine. A really, really interesting moment for anyone who wants to take a look at Eastern Europe, because again, we haven't had a football tournament with the exception of this tiny thing in Czechoslovakia in Eastern Central Europe through the modern era, and this is the first time. And it was quite a struggle. You know, there was a lot of people who were kind of sucking their teeth and going, I don't know about this. It's going to Poland, Ukraine, a bold move by Michel Platini at the head of UEFA, I think, to take it there. And what is extraordinary about this is the some of the attitudes that you will find in football stadiums in Poland and Ukraine. And I dearly hope we don't actually get to see them when it comes to the tournament. But it's worth noting how extraordinary, how deep these symbolic and political displays will go. There's a number of organisations that monitor racism and anti-Semitism in football in Europe. And they've been working overtime in Poland and Ukraine in the last 3 years. I mean, they counted something in the region of 400 major incidents of racism at football grounds in the last couple of years in Poland and Ukraine. And just to give you a sense of the depth of this, you will find at Ukrainian football banners across the width of an entire stadium that display the iconography of Ukrainian Waffen SS divisions. Right? You will hear chanting against the Roma, you will hear chanting against the Jews, you will find the signs and symbols of the Ku Klux Klan prominently displayed in provincial Poland. I mean, I find this, and it's at football. How extraordinary that those marginalised groups should take this iconography and take it to football games of all places in which to display and express this. The other thing on the Euros, while I'm thinking about it, is at 2008, just to show you that it's not just the English or the Eastern Europeans that go wild about this, there was a game between Russia and Sweden. I think it was for qualifying? Could have been the quarterfinals. And this is just a taste of the new Russia. On Russian state television, right, before, pretty much in every gap between programs for 3 days before the Russia-Sweden game, they run a video of the Battle of Poltava. Okay, those of you who are not familiar, it's the decisive 18th century struggle between the Swedish crown and the Tsarist Empire, and the Russians. The Russians finally win and boot the Swedes out. You know, not only that, they even show footage of communist era movies of the medieval battles. Is it Nizhny Novgorod? Right? And they're running these, you know, and they're running them next to the news. In Poland. Poland played their opening, one of their key games against Germany. Okay, so there's a lot of bad blood, we know there. But the Polish press start publishing pictures on their front pages of Leo Beenhakker, who's a sort of very, you know, genteel Dutchman, all right? And it's sort of photoshopped, I believe, from Gladiator, the Hollywood movie. Okay, and he's got Michael Ballack's head, right, in one hand, dripping blood, and he's got Joachim Löw, who's the coach, in the other hand, like this. So, you know, this is never expressed outside of football. So football provides a strange space in which often the otherwise unsayable, I think, can be said, as well as the more benign versions of kind of popular nationalism. We also get some great extremes. So keep a look at the tabloid press during Euro 2012. Some of the darker side of Europe is sure to be on show during it. Let me now go back to Britain and to the Olympics and try and pick up on that moment in Euro 96. As historians, you know, we all love a document, and I don't know about you, but I really love marginalia. I love it when someone's written something funny in the margins, you know, in a committee meeting, and you get that. And there's an apocryphal tale of Churchill apparently annotated a document which he disapproved of, and he put round objects, right, balls, next to it. And some civil servant underneath it went, "Who is round and why does he object?" Well, here's a little bit of marginalia for future historians of a Downing Street press conference in 2008 at Christmas. And Gordon Brown, the then Labour Prime Minister, has been grilled, as you might imagine, about the greatest banking and financial crisis to engulf British capitalism in 60 years. And then, slightly off the cuff, one of the journalists says, "And Prime Minister Brown, what would you most like for Christmas?" And he says, "A British football team for the London 2012 Olympics." The man is in the middle of the greatest crisis that British capitalism has faced in 60 years. And the top, okay, maybe it's a little glib to want financial stability as your Christmas wish, but as the top of your kind of second rank political wish list, which is essentially what that question is designed to elicit, the London 2012 Olympics should have a great British football team. And it's like, how could it be an issue for the host nation of the Olympics to put together a host team to play the national sport? How extraordinary that the Prime Minister should deem that problem so great that it was worthy of his time and attention. This is the degree in the twilight of the British imperial state of how much football has become an element and an actor in the redefinition and interpretation of the meaning of national identity. Why is it a problem? Well, of course, long before there was FIFA, long before there was the International Olympic Committee, the English, Welsh, Irish, and Scottish football associations are formed. They're all formed by 1883. Right, long before any of this. And the interesting thing about football in Britain in this regard is there was never any question at the time that there would be a British Football Association. It was always understood that it would be along these older kind of cultural national lines that it formed up, partly a question of transportation. And I'm still digging around, I have to say, in the archives on this to really kind of pin down But it was no question, it was going to be England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. And indeed, international football, for the first 30 years of football existence, is exclusively games between England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland, right? Because nobody else has actually got a football association or is playing international games. So when FIFA comes along in 1904 and is founded, you know, they're begging the home nations, please, please, please join us. You know, you're the people who invented the game. You know, you've got to come in. And of course, the English FA, you know, is looking down its nose. I mean, they say they're going to go to the meetings, they don't go. They promise they're going to write back, they don't write back. Every stalling device you can imagine. Eventually, FIFA says, okay, we're just going to form up without you guys. And then the English, the Scottish, the Welsh and the Irish come in. But they're not happy about it. It's under sufferance. And indeed, they leave on two occasions before finally rejoining FIFA in 1946. So it's very much an independent operation in terms of England, Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. In the Olympics, by comparison, the IOC, right, shows no favours to anyone in that regard, right? FIFA was very much in, the people who set it up were very much in awe of the English, the Scottish, the Welsh and the Irish, right? Whereas the IOC is in awe of no one. You have to be in awe of the IOC. And they deal with sovereign nation states because that is the nature of the Olympics from very early on. So at the Olympics, it's always Great Britain, which is an issue for the Northern Irish, of course, because you understand that the full title of the state is the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland is not part of Great Britain. Okay, Great Britain is a truncation of the title, and the Northern Irish, depending on which side, well, no one's very happy about it in Northern Ireland. But it's Team GB. And the International Olympic Committee say you have to have a British team if you want to be in the tournament. You can't come as England or Scotland or Northern Ireland as Wales because we do not recognise these as National Olympic Committees. This has always been a problem in the past, but it's not been a problem because basically the British never cared. Any of the football associations, it was like football at the Olympics? Ah. You know, not important, not significant. We sent amateur teams, you know, and no one's bothered by it. It didn't become a political issue in any way. They sent basically, as I say, amateur teams, and no one cared. But this is Britain's Olympics, and you've got to have, you know, it was felt you have to have a football team. How can you have a football tournament in Britain and not have some representative? So we get to the point where Gordon Brown is actually personally going to FIFA to argue the case about it, because the home nations, the English, are saying, all right, we'll have a great British football team. We're not happy, but we'll have it. The Scots, the Northern Irish and the Welsh are absolutely adamant. They won't even enter into negotiations over it. They have explicitly told their players, you know, you won't be punished, but we are not happy if you play. We'd much prefer it if you don't play in a British team. And certainly amongst the kind of commentariat and the political class, the argument is, right, post-devolution, you want to have a British team with Scots in it? You must be joking. No one. Well, this is complete folly. Why is this so important to the Labour government? Why should a politician spend so much time over this? Well, the Labour government are the people who introduced devolution to Britain after the 1997 landslide. The Blair government comes to power, and they come to power committed to Scottish and Welsh referenda on creating devolved government. In the case of Scotland, to actually reactivate the Scottish Parliament after nearly 300 years of kind of silent life. And they've had to do so because the pressure on the periphery from nationalists is forcing them that way. And I don't know if you're aware of the political geography of Britain, but the Labour Party cannot win with really without Scotland and Wales because a huge amount of their votes and their MPs come from Scotland and Wales. So they had to support that. But what they didn't do was think, OK, if we're going to do that, we really ought to think the whole constitutional arrangement, right? We actually think of having a written constitution. We have to think about where England fits into this. Maybe it's an opportunity to renovate, you know, some of the most medieval aspects of the British constitution. None of this is considered. It's all brushed under the carpet. And the Scots and the Welsh duly go ahead and they vote, of course, to to have independent government of some kind or another. And in the last 10 years, it's become, you know, Britain looks different to everybody. First of all, the separate and distinct political cultures of Scotland and Wales have come to the fore. And you can see these are much more socially democratic, consensually aligned societies, quite different from England. And in terms of public policy, they're looking different. Plus, you have an incredible asymmetry about devolution. And that asymmetry is that, first of all, the West Lothian question, as it's called. West Lothian is a small part, it's a constituency in the central belt of Scotland. And you have a situation where Scots and Welsh MPs, Scots MPs particularly, still go to Westminster. And they can vote on all the laws that are passed in Westminster, which includes all the law that affects England and Wales. Okay, but most Scottish law is now made in the Scottish Parliament, where nobody at Westminster has any stake. So how can it be the Scots get to vote on their own and they get to vote on English legislation? A lot of people in England beginning to scratch their heads about that. Secondly, in an era of austerity where questions of public expenditure are coming under greater and greater scrutiny, the English public has finally woken up to the fact that it is in effect subsidising Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. In fact, we have a formula called the Barnett formula, created in the 1970s, which divvies up public expenditure. And Scotland and Wales automatically get more per capita head than England. So the English question, which the Labour Party in particular has been desperate not to ask, desperate not to explore, in part because they fear very kind of revanchist, ethnic and racist forms of English nationalism, has just been all pushed to one side. But it can't be, you can see, it can't be hidden any longer. The English people, such as we are, have finally gone, ooh, there is an England. It's not just Britain anymore. And the Scots might actually be off in a minute. We're going to have a referendum on independence and they'll probably bottle it right at the end. But actually, you've got to start thinking about the constitutional setup. So you have a moment where Englishness is finally, after being hidden inside the cultural and institutional form of Britain, is finally exposed. This is a moment for the invention of popular modern nationalisms, as you might imagine. But most modern nationalisms, one way or the other, if they don't go down the ethnic route, they go down the civic institutional route. That's the basis around which you begin to try and build a conception of your community of fate, of your shared ethnic identity, of your collective history and destiny. And Scotland, I mean, the Scottish nation, you know, never disappeared. The Scottish nation may not have had a parliament, but it's been a nation for the last 300 years, and it has at its core distinctive Scottish institutions of law, Scottish institutions of higher education, and indeed more popular forms of education, and of course the Scottish church as well. So the Scottish nation has these institutions. Where can the English go? What are the English institutions? The royal family? You know, British at best, maybe German at worst. The Westminster Parliament, clearly British. The armed forces, British. The BBC, what better icon of the nation? British, you know, founded by a Scotsman, you know, multinational in its outlook, definitely not English. The English language, we share it with the rest of the world. The English literary canon, maybe, but that is pretty rich sorts for most people when it comes to inventing conceptions of popular nationalism. The English National Opera, which is one of the very few explicitly English cultural institutions. I've been to see an ENO performance where they do kind of Italian opera in English. That's going nowhere. No one's going to be rallying around that. The singularly most important distinctive English national institution around which a theatre of public expression of national identity has been made in the last 20 years is the England national football team. It's a sad tale, but it is absolutely, it is a dangerous, you know, the Uruguayans have been down this route. You know, Uruguay wins two Olympics and then two World Cups and completely reinvents its popular national identity around its particular version of football. And then you're no good at football for 50 years after that. And there's nothing else in the historic cupboard to reinvent yourself with. It's a pretty difficult move to make. But that is where the English are. Just absolutely extraordinarily. That is where it has been. So that is where Euro 96, that moment of flags in Wembley, comes from. And it doesn't stop there. In 2006, right, at the World Cup in Germany, retailers sold over 11 million flags in England. 11 million flags. I mean, the adult population is what, 35 million? That's a lot of flags being sold, and I can tell you, plastered absolutely everywhere. And I suppose, I mean, I've only got 5 minutes left, so what I want to say is, I suppose, there's a really interesting struggle going on. There's a lot of different Englands that people are trying to invent. I mean, we have a lot of intellectuals who are finally, the intellectual class and historians, are beginning to think about, is there an English history rather than a British history, and begin to sift, you know, what's English, what's British, or what bit of British is like the English bit and what's the Scottish bit, and that sort of historical sifting. But again, you know, I'm checking that out, but most folks are not checking that story out. That debate's not happening for them. So we've got a little movement there, but it's really around the England national football team. And we have, I suppose, a couple of little videos just to give you a flavour of that cultural debate. And I'm going to show you some of the positive side and some of the sort of mad negative side of it as well, and the struggle that's going on. Let me do this, the negative side, which is an English national identity that is still effectively British, that have not cut the umbilical cord from Britishness, where England still lives inside the sort of fantasy land of Britain, and Britain as defined by its imperial experience of the Second World War. I'm standing on the roof of a car park in Bloemfontein, right? It's on the top of a mall. The Germans may get to the swimming pool first, but the Brits get to the mall and the bar. And this place is just mobbed with the English, okay? And down below is all the drinking, and I'm with the smoking crew on the roof looking down. And there's a whole crew of England fans up there, like two slightly distinct worlds. And it's awash with red and white. Suddenly, a German staff car, World War II vintage, right, with two cartoon Nazis shows up round the corner. But they're English. I can see from their faces, the flags on the back. They've dressed up as Germans, right, for the game for England versus Germany. And there's what I call the Stag Night group, right, down there, which is, you know, 10 to 15 blokes. They've all got the same T-shirt, on tour from Bristol or whatever. And they've got these hats on, which are a bit like, you know, the magicians who do the balloon shapes and they make poodles out of it. Okay, they've got balloons turned into World War II Spitfires on their head, all right, which is the kind of character. That's the plane that won the Battle of Britain, okay. So that's pretty weird anyway. And they burst into song when the English dressed as Germans, right, are encouraging the song. And it's such a shameful and awful song, but I will sing a bit of it for you anyway. And it's to the tune of Coming Round the Mountain, just in case my voice doesn't carry it, which it won't. And they sing, there were 10 German bombers in the air, 10 German bombers in the air. Okay, so that's a bad start. And then here's the punchline. And the RAF from England shot them down. And I went, the RAF from England? The RAF is not from England. The RAF, like all of the imperial military political institutions, are British. It's not the same thing. And yet these people are reliving the notion of English national identity through the imperial experience of the Second World War, and in particular in relationship to the Germans. And I just, you know, and not only that, but there were a lot of German fans around as well, and they're all like me, just like looking on, like, what are you guys on? Because they're not singing it to the Germans, they're singing it to our own invented caricature of the Germans. And someone's bothered to hire a car and dress up for this pantomime. So there is the kind of, that's the problematic old school, but there are signs of hope. There are signs of hope of a more playful, generous, humane Englishness. An Englishness that draws on other strands of popular culture beyond the British imperial state, that draws on musical, on comedy, on song, on the kind of drunken conviviality that characterises a lot of everyday life in England. And that's the image I will leave you with. I'm in Lisbon, 2004, the European Championships. And I'm standing on the platform of the sparkling new Lisbon Metro with a friend, and we're going to the game between England and Croatia. Or is it England and France? I think it's England and Croatia. And it's pretty full. We're filling up. And you know how it is in the Metro. Everybody's slightly inching towards where they think the doors are going to be, because we all know that the train's going to be pretty full, right? Because this is the train to the England game, and it's going to be packed. So this train, I should explain. Do you know the song Knees Up Mother Brown? You do. I won't ask you to sing it. Knees Up Mother Brown is like your classic Cockney party song. You know, it was very popular in the English music hall, and it goes, Knees Up Mother Brown, Knees Up Mother Brown, da 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 da. Okay, so that's the tune, all right? So that's the kind of roots of this thing. So this train pulls in, and it's also sung by football supporters, particularly at West Ham. Anyway, so this train comes in and we all inch forward and we look at the train as it comes in, and we all know we're absolutely no chance of getting on this train because it is full, every single space, with England fans, right? Absolutely packed. And I would say demographically it was interesting, you know, black faces in that crowd, some women, not exclusively the old school of England fan. You sense the demographic change, although incomplete. And so we all just sort of stand there in silence because we know, you know, we're not shuffling forward. We know there's no chance. The train stops, silence on the platform, the hiss of the doors, and it's like someone flicked the mute switch, right, on a computer. The entire train, six carriages, all in unison, to the tune of Knees Up Mother Brown, start singing, you're not getting on, you're not getting on, you're not getting, you're not getting, you're not getting on. Hiss, doors close, train rolls away. And like, we all just burst into hysterical laughter. And I suppose it's that moment, you know, there are those dual poles of the contortions of English nationalism, which is a process that is not over. It's rumbling on, watch this space. It's so extraordinary that it should be expressed through the medium of football. And yet, as I began my little talk, when we look around the world, we find actually it's not so extraordinary in deal. It's to be expected. We just have to kind of open our eyes sometimes and take a look.
All right, this tradition in the department, we open these up and have a very frank Q&A, so feel free to ask David questions, he'll answer, and we'll take it from there. And I'll moderate, so to speak.
Sorry, misspelled that a bit, right? That was really fascinating. And being an expat from Britain, left about 7 years ago, I was going to ask you, so a lot of that that kind of 96 kind of good feeling, this feeling about being kind of part of English identity, emerged from this kind of discourse of a classless society, that we didn't have a kind of working class anymore, that they had been subsumed into the middle class in some way. Now, yet last year it was very clear that there is, whether you like to call it working class or what what right-wing commentators would call the lumpen proletariat, rioted on the streets of London. There clearly are major class divisions in England. So I wonder how that's tying into this kind of discovery of a kind of English identity around the Olympics. I mean,
okay, now the Olympics is great. I mean, it's really, you know, you can't talk about England and not talk about class. So absolutely right to go there. I mean, with the Olympics, it's less, you know, the issue is about Britishness. And it's also, I should say, the other issue with the Olympics is that it's not actually Britain's Olympics. No, the government thinks that. But everybody knows it's London's Olympics. And one of the kind of most important things about the political geography, I would say, of Britain, and certainly in the last 10 years, is a really profound sense that London and the southeast around it have become economically, politically, and socially a distinct zone. and, you know, pretty vampirically leeching off the rest of the country in many ways. And the Olympics feels very much like, you know, God, London's got it all anyway, and it's getting the Olympics. And the attempts to sort of regionalise the Olympics or kind of give it a Scottish face or a Welsh face, I don't think have been successful or well received. So that would be the Olympic point. I mean, in terms of class, you know, we know the Gini coefficient is higher than it has been since the mid-1930s. Inequality across a whole range of social divisions is huge. Class is central to it. I think the thing with football and class and England is that part of the gigantic levels of engagement and, above all, nostalgia. There's a lot of nostalgia and a lot of, you know, people kind of situating themselves within their families, their communities and their own personal narratives through football is a great big nostalgic requiem for the death of social democratic Britain and the organised working class that existed within it. You know, the dominant imagery of what makes proper football, authentic football, is all drawn from an era that no longer exists. So we have a strange conversation in which we actually are talking about class, and we are talking about the decimation, I would say, of traditional working class industrial communities that existed in England, you know, even 25 years ago. You know, it's a great big, yeah, nostalgia fest and kind of sense of regret. You know, that's part of the appeal of what football is. Is there still class? Is it still represented in football today? I mean, unquestionably. I mean, you know, you only have to look at who are footballers. I mean, there is virtually class apartheid in terms of football players. I mean, everywhere in the world, you know, poor, unskilled men gravitate to football and indeed sports, you know, of all kinds that are not super elitist and expensive sports. But I would say it is sharper and harsher in England than anywhere that I've encountered. And you have, as well as the sort of sheer demographics of it, a situation where no footballer can admit to any kind of middle class pleasure, interest. I mean, we only have to think of poor old Gareth Southgate, you know, who had the temerity to read the Guardian newspaper and was therefore considered irredeemably homosexual and unacceptable. I mean, just a whole load of prejudices all just piled into one. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, I would say. Well, the funny thing is, and then you get Frank Lampard, who went to a very sheeshy private school, but because he's got footballing tradition in the family and comes from an unimpeachably working class family by origin, and football fans know that, you know, and he just plays the game, doesn't he? Frank's a lot cleverer. He's got 11 O-levels, we know that much, could have definitely gone to university, but he plays that game because it's unacceptable. You know, I mean, I think within the English part of dressing rooms, I think it's unacceptable as well. So, you know, class is alive and well in English football. Have modern conceptions of English nationalism begun to think a bit harder about, you know, are we going to have, is modern England going to be as class-ridden and status-obsessed as you know, as the old versions? I don't think we've got, the debate's not at a sufficient level of maturity yet to have really engaged that. People are still slopping around for Englishness before they get, you know, and so the left is thinking about radical traditions in the English Civil War and lost English folk music traditions. You know, there are different ways of going at it. But that central issue of class, I don't think we've got there yet. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with you that soccer stadiums have become arenas for social expression in different groups in terms of ethnicity, national, transnational, global identities. My question is regarding the forces behind that, because everybody that has gone to a soccer stadium, watch a match in a soccer stadium, knows that what is broadcast is not necessarily the same as what happens in the stadium, right? Mm. And there is a process of mass consumption in terms of, you know, Englishness that becomes a commodity, Mexicanness, or whatever you want to call it, in targeting specific audiences to become mass consumers of this product that is controlled not by these old clubs in the working class neighborhoods in England, but now by the media and corporations, right? So I wanted to know to what extent we need to really pay attention to what is behind all these processes, who controls the stadiums, who owns the stadiums, right? And who projects those images that happily coincide with a mass consumption market, right? In which football is a global commodity like cocaine or shoes or any other type of commodities that is produced to be consumed by the masses, not by the members of a gentrified club or middle class that is aspiring or anything like that, but by masses of people that can identify with either, you know, England in this case, or Mexico in the United States, or Colombia in Miami, Florida, right?
I've given the kind of crude version, and quite rightly, you know, what has produced the theatre of experimental English nationalism is not just football fans. It's a complex ensemble that is partly football fans in the stadium, is partly the team and the manager, you know, because how they play and what kind of play they produce affects it. The media, both in terms of the people who are actually kind of covering the broadcasts and very shapely direct what goes into homes, but also just as importantly, particularly in England, the tabloid press have been absolutely central to kind of framing this, shaping this, both reporting what fans do as well as the kind of language and terminology for describing the football itself, and then the public at home. So you've actually, it's like a quadrant, I suppose, of those four forces. And, you know, to say that it is a process that is not marked by inequalities of power, of course, is naive and foolish. And football fans, you know, for the most part, are not even reflective about that. I suppose what interests me in this is, you know, that's true of pretty much all forms of expressions of popular nationalism, you know, is that kind of, it's not just spontaneous from below, it's always mediated, controlled and shaped by other forces. I think what's interesting for me about the football, for looking at soccer in particular, is that crowds are sufficiently spontaneous and uncontrollable that stuff happens that you can't stop getting into the newspapers, and that there is actually a space for unusual and kind of expressions from below that you just don't have in other areas. So at least you've got some space. That doesn't mean it's on equal terms, but you've got some space. Plus, it's just a bit of an unpredictable thing. I mean, both crowds and football, the story often goes wrong. You know, the story that the press or that, you know, people who want to shape the agenda would like to tell, it doesn't happen, usually because the England football team is so disastrous. I mean, that's what's so great about it, is that, you know, the same cycle of, you know, we're going to win, we're going to win, we're going to win. Oh, well, shit.
Because that's one thing that, you know, that is really a, you know, British or an English tradition, right? That the English teams, you know, they suck. They've been sucking for years and decades, right?
Yeah.
But there is a sense of spectatorship by which they have, the spectators know that the stadium is a performance place, and that you could use that as a performance place, and they go there to perform too.
Yep.
They have a soccer game, you know, to be performed there.
Absolutely.
And they portray themselves as the best fans in the world, in contrast to the performance or the athletic performance of.
Absolutely. And you have, I mean, one of the interesting thing about England fans is, you know, you've had for the first time a sort of real conscious attempt, both in quite informal, small-scale ways, as well as quite large and organised ways, to shape that performance and transform the imagery that's being beamed back. I mean, much of the first, you know, much of the 1990s and into the early 2000s, the whole issue was, you know, there was always trouble. There was always trouble. And, you know, how can you, those who were kind of thinking this is a place to perform some sort of sense of what England is about, and we've really got to not have the violence because that is screwing it up every time. So you've actually got people reacting to that. You know, you've got grassroots fans initiatives in terms of trying to stop that sort of stuff happening. You've got active anti-racist campaigns inside England football fans, which you've never had before. And you've also got a lot of folks who are just going, what can I do and bring to the carnival? You know, people, we hadn't had this for years, people actually bring instruments, you know. I mean, England's a very musical place, right? I mean, in terms of its pop cultural traditions, it's, you know, it's one of the kind of centres, and yet we'd never had any of that coming to the stadium. And now that's coming, you know, that's coming to the stadium. People are discovering the carnivalesque for the first time, you know, and dressing up in different ways, and, you know, So that's, you know, that's what I kind of really intrigues me about it, is that it just opens up enough little space for some of that stuff to happen and some of those kind of caricatures to be challenged. And I think particularly, you know, to give England fans their due on questions of ethnicity in particular, you know, and the presence of black and Asian fans in the crowd and in terms of dealing with racist chanting, it's a real change. You know, England does not sound, England, an England crowd does not sound like it did 10, 15 years ago. Is that permanent? I hope so. I don't know. But, you know, you can see real change there. And, yeah, to have black faces, large numbers of black faces in an England crowd, this is a major shift in the way the nation thinks about itself. I mean, I think it has made a small contribution to the limits of kind of ethnic nationalism in England, which is reduced to the kind of absolute fringes of the English Defence League and so on. And it's like most punters, even, you know, pretty right-wing folks or folks you wouldn't normally associate with kind of multiculturalism, it's like England is clearly not white anymore, you know, and I think we've all basically got the message. And this is like, you know, for England, this is major advance. And you can see it in the team, you can see it in the fans. So good can come of it.
Outside of English history and outside of any sports or soccer history. I wonder while listening, maybe this is an obvious question for others. So there are many fields of cultural activity where national identities or conflicts get grafted on. Why is it particularly soccer? Maybe it's sports more general, but in this, but why is it particularly soccer that becomes this powerful arena, which it obviously is, and I agree. What I was thinking, so a couple of weeks ago we had the Oscars, right? And in the Oscars, there was a foreign film category. There was a competition between two movies, an Israeli film and an Iranian film. And the Iranian film got the Oscar. And the Iranian press said, we beat the Zionists. But that doesn't get that kind of, obviously that's not central, as soccer is. And I want to advance a quick theory on interpretation, which is this. There's a clear connection to warfare in a lot of what you said. You said that in Denmark, the soccer celebration is the biggest public gathering, I think it was in Denmark, since liberation.
Yeah.
And you spoke about the Battle of Poltava or something being shown on...
Yeah, Poltava. Yeah,
Russian TV, something like that. Before, clear connections to warfare. I want to suggest that perhaps what is so effective about soccer, put it in a broader context, is that we live in an age since World War II where warfare is being muddied down, and wars don't end with clear resolutions. Less and less. It's not clear who's fighting who. It's very unclear who's won and who lost. Wars kind of fizzle out. World War II was the last great war about which we have a clear narrative, supposedly about winners and losers. We still have that in soccer, that clarity. And at the end of it, there's a clear resolution. There's a match of physical prowess, to a large extent, like warfare, and a clear resolution. Perhaps that need for a clear form of warfare without the violence in the way, or without, hopefully without the violence, without some, and there is some violence. Perhaps that explains part of the great effectiveness of this form of sports in expressing all these national identities and conflicts. It's just a...
There's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, in the process of trying, you know, imagine communities are actually hard for most folks, you know, to come up with, you know, to create. And so I think all sports in general offer that by offering the imagined community of 11 players. It's kind of just much easier to think about, and it dramatizes it in a way that most folks can make sense of. I mean, I think partly the war thing, it is, you know, as, I mean, Orwell argued, you know, it is war minus the shooting. It has many of the same kind of dynamics in play, and there is truth in that. I think it's also, you know, that for in the popular consciousness, you know, interstate relations are mainly understood and remembered through war. You know, I mean, most folks, you know, the actual popular histories that most people carry around in their heads, you know, there's a few wars, basically, are the markers. I think it's interesting, though, in the case of Denmark, although that gathering, I referenced it to the liberation in size, what is being expressed by the Danes at that moment is definitely not a kind of military thing. It's about being, I mean, on the contrary, it's about, you know, the European community, which is first and foremost about stopping war and, you know, moving on from that kind of interstate relationship. So it's a sort of celebration of Denmark's place that even within, you know, within the European community, the small guys can still have a voice. And of course, you know, everybody's, even 60, 70 years on, everybody's relationship with Germany and Europe is still kind of filtered through the wartime experience. But I think certainly the Danes anyway had moved. I don't think they thought about that or experience that in a militaristic or military matter. England, however, and Britain, you know, whose whole, you know, notion of what it is so closely tied to imperial expansion and military relationships, I think those things absolutely are to the fore, and I could have gone on forever. I mean, we only just touched the surface, you know. Nelson and Trafalgar, Richard the Lionheart, you know. The only thing that's off limits, interestingly, is World War One. They very rarely reference World War One. I don't quite, occasionally we get, you know, photoshops of, do you know, Your Country Needs You, the poster of Kitchener. Occasionally they'll put like Wayne Rooney's face or something on Kitchener, and you get, but otherwise World War One is kind of slightly off limits. So I think you're right that it has many of the structural features of military conflict, plus it has, and I think this is true not just of military conflicts, but also big economic and political change. The European Union, good thing, bad thing, victory, defeat. I mean, the British people haven't worked out that one. So I think, but you're right, football and all sports does offer the clear narrative and the decisive, the clear, decisive, comprehensible narrative. I think the other thing it's worth noting is also, football is particularly good at this because, A, it's a team game, right? You never get this. We have our individual athletic heroes. We love tennis players. But no one's quite doing it like team sports. I mean, the collectivity as a representative of the imagined community. And then I think football particularly functions well in this regard because of the scale of it. I mean, I often think about basketball, which in many ways is quite a similar, uncoached, very fluid, very dynamic sort of game, you know, has that in common with football. But you can only get 25,000 people around a basketball stadium. You can't get 100,000 people around the court. And I think for the sort of ecstasy, otherworldliness, carnivalesque quality of the football crowd, which is what makes these moments, I think, in part happen, there's something about the physicality of the stadium and the dynamic of the play that delivers it. So it is, you know, there's elements of that, you know, war as metaphor, substitute as war, but I don't think it's the whole, one can slightly overplay it, is all I suppose I would say. Yeah.
Yeah, what a wonderful talk. I've got so many questions, I don't know where to begin. But you're an Englishman living in America during the primary campaign, and you've seen some of the right-wing Republicans waving the flag and paying to represent America.
Yeah.
Rugby, and this soccer culture you're describing does not resonate with them. And second, and related to that, how come if the soccer is becoming such a focus of English nationalism, did they choose an Italian manager who's now fired? They were willing to do that.
And a Swede, let's not forget, as well. Really great questions. I mean, what I would say is, I was reading Orwell the other day, who had exactly this dilemma when trying to think about Englishness, and he does this beautiful description. Do you remember John Major and his Maids on Bicycles, which is a bad rip-off of the original Orwell? And Orwell's is actually about, specifically about England, not Britain, and it's actually a much more fulsome and cross-class description. And he said, how can one make a nation out of these fragments? You know, he scratched his head over that. And I did too as I was reading it. And I would say two things. First of all, in terms of the rugby cricket thing, We've actually had a bit of that. You know, I mean, the way in which English rugby crowds operate, I mean, particularly because of the success of the 2003 World Cup, you have quite a kind of home counties, upper middle class blokishness about English nationalism and rugby that you don't have, which is in a way almost a compliment to the English nationalism expressed in soccer stadiums. And cricket's such an interesting one, because cricket, we lost it. I mean, if we'd have gone back to that, we were talking about the 1950s, I would say cricket is still virtually the national game in the 1950s. You know, the monoculture that is modern England English sport, where it's soccer, 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 and everything is a second-class citizen, is a reasonably recent phenomena. So I think there's always been an element of Englishness expressed through cricket, most definitely. And that's come back a bit as England have got a bit better. I mean, if one was in England for the Ashes in 2005, or you check out the Barmy Army, as they're called, which is, you know, the all-travelling, all-drinking England support that follows the English cricket team, you see a lot of the same sort of tropes and imagery and so on. So I think there's a bit of a crossover there. You know, you've got a supporting cast alongside soccer that is expressing slight variants of that English nationalism in other sports and other contexts. In terms of how does the soccer thing resonate, I mean, you know, well, let's just, you know, it's a pretty masculine football nation still. So I don't think we can claim, you know, that it's properly representative of the nation as a whole. You know, it's very masculine, it's still predominantly white, etc., etc. What I would say is that, you know, part of the gentrification of football in the last 20 years is that it is truly cross-class now. I think, you know, there's no bit of the social scale that's not doing football in England. I mean, even Prince Charles, I think this is a really interesting moment. No, you know, prior to the last 10 years, no member of the royal family showed any interest in football. Sure, they're the patron of the FA and they show up for the FA Cup and they hand out the gongs, but, you know, they're not interested. Prince Charles has actually admitted his team is Burnley, right? Partly because he's got a load of charities there. Prince William clearly likes football, right? David Cameron is the first, you know, and John Major are the first conservative leaders to admit to a kind of preference in football. Prior to Thatcher hated it. Ted Heath had, you know, he was interested in sailing and orchestral music and whatever, you know. And similarly on the Labour side, they're not interested. So I just think we've got a much more cross-class, you know, if you look at Chelsea's, you know, Chelsea season ticket holders, 50% are earning more than, what would it be, $75,000 a year. So we've got a real, you know, and again, people bemoan this. I mean, that's, we come back to the whole kind of requiem for the lost social democratic working class England. So I think football in that regard, and particularly when the national team play, although it's never more than a proxy and an approximation, it's not a billion miles away. It's getting a lot closer. No one should read the fate of English nationalism and English national identity from the football team and the crowd alone. This would be naive. But it's not a bad place to start, I suppose, is what I'm saying, and a stronger place to start than it would have been 20, 30, 40 years ago.
One interesting footnote, just before you go in, one interesting footnote, which you again know better than I do, the one place you'll still see a Union Jack in a football ground today is in Scotland.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, that's a whole, my God, let's, you know, and you'll see it at Linfield in Belfast amongst the unionists. And I mean, the funny thing with the Union Jack, it comes third. Where you see it at England games now is a standard flag will be the flag of St. George, a little Union Jack ensign in the corner, and then across the bottom, something like Bristol Rovers, the Gas on Tour. So Britain is third after kind of club, region, city, and the English nation. I mean, were you trying to stop me there?
No.
Sorry, I thought I caught you out of the corner of my eye. So, yeah.
Multiple
identities. Yeah, but with English right up there.
You see the same phenomenon with English boxing fans. Especially when the fight is in Las Vegas, when they bring a European, you know, champion to fight in Las Vegas,
yeah.
This Englishness, that this song appears in soccer, you know, going into the boxing match.
Okay.
There's chants and there are, you know, the flags and there's this
which flags? Union Jacks or St. George's flags?
St. George, you know.
Okay.
The Red Cross and
yeah, the yeah. Okay.
I'm trying to get my head around my question a little bit. Thanks a lot for talking.
I was wondering a little bit about one element of why international football is a particularly apt site for nationalist expressions. And I was wondering about a few different things. But I was particularly curious about the curious paradox that football can be seen as sort of a transcendent, apolitical force in the world, and that it's sort of okay, on the one hand, then to express your nationalism within that. But it also seems to me that there's a deeper connection there, and that is that, you know, there's also somewhat of a supposition behind nationalism. At the same time, you're having all these, you know, parochial expressions and class expressions and revanchist expressions that you were very good about showing. But there is a bit of an underlying idea that ultimately nationalism binds people together.
Hmm.
Very different kinds of backgrounds, different kinds of political beliefs, and particularly in liberal states and that kind of thing.
Hmm.
So I was just thinking a little bit about, you know, perhaps there's something very particular about this, about soccer as kind of being an apolitical sort of entity, or at least the way it presents itself as being apolitical. That is actually, in a curious way, and that apolitical side, you know, is often talked about as, oh, well, this is just games, we're all brought together, and isn't this wonderful? So there's sort of an international side to it. But it also seems to me that that is then, in a particular way, that can be used with inside of national imaginary, because it is, precisely because it's sort of apolitical, and it's supposed to be binding, and it's supposed to supersede the differences that we have.
I think that's very true. I think in England, I mean, England and Scotland are an interesting comparison here. In the case of England, I mean, football and soccer has become, in day-to-day life, you know, in conversation in the workplace, as well as actually at the stadium, a sort of real cross-class, cross-ethnic place. And it is, you know, yeah, there's an Englishness that is not about, you know, can be, you know, broken down by class and ethnicity. So that's definitely going on. And that, I think that is part of the kind of the success of it. It is the kind of common ground of everyday life. And it's particularly sharp in England, whereas in America, you know, one's attention is diverted by many sports. All these conversations are happening. It's just about, pretty much about soccer. However, it doesn't happen just like that. It has to be made to happen. And the great example of this is the Tartan Army, where on the one hand, you know, it's presented as the Scottish, you know, here's a representation of the Scottish nation, unified and undivided. But it's only made possible by the unspoken rule that you never wear Celtic colours and you never wear Rangers colours if you're with the Tartan Army. In fact, you don't even say what your religious or your club affiliation is. Right, because the moment you let the sectarian element of the Scottish nation in through the back door, the Scottish nation starts, you know, breaking apart. So, you know, it's Jane's face, isn't it, nationalism,
well,
in that respect.
Why there's so much tension around